He was a morbidly obese surgeon destined for an operating table and an early death. Now he's a rebel MD who is fabulously fit and fighting to make America healthy again. This is Stay Off My Operating Table with Dr. Philip Ovadia.
Hey, folks. As you know, it's the Stay Off My Operating Table podcast with Dr. Philip Ovadia. And we've got a muscle head here with us today. I love it when we have these guys, frankly, because I feel like I'm probably more amongst my people, even though nobody would ever accuse me of being one of those. But I didn't go to medical school, so it's nice to have somebody who's over on my side of the fence. Introduce our guests, Phil. Our guest.
Sure thing. We got, I think, what is probably one of the most intelligent muscle heads I think out there, and really at the forefront.
I'm going to say I don't think Jack realizes I have a PhD in biomedical engineering.
Exactly. We got Dr. John.
I knew it was
John
a PhD, but it's not an MD. So you know, I
just have better handwriting.
Exactly.
They won't
exactly.
Let you in med school if you can read your handwriting, right?
And just hasn't been brainwashed in the same way that most MDs have these days. So I'm really excited to have Dr. Jaquish on. John's book, Weightlifting is a Waste of Time, I think is a real eye-opening read for anyone that's not familiar with it. And his scientific approach to muscle building, really excited to get into today. But before we do that, Dr. Jaquish, why don't you give a little bit of your background to our audience and maybe explain how you got so interested in the science of building muscle?
Sure. It actually had nothing to do with muscle. It started about 15 years ago when my mother was diagnosed with osteoporosis. She was very upset. I was in the middle of getting my MBA at the time. I wasn't medical focused at all. And so she was very upset, and she told me about the side effects of the medications that are typically prescribed for osteoporosis. And she read them out loud, and I was like, yeah, I wouldn't want to take those drugs either. But she's like, I'm worried about a fragility fracture. And I was like, let me just read about this, because this might not be the only option. And I also just intuitively thought, like, osteoporosis is a lack of mechanical loading on bone. Like, I knew that already. So why would we be solving a mechanical problem with a chemical solution? Why would it not be a mechanical solution to a mechanical problem? And so it was like, well, okay. Exercise. Why does exercise not do, well, really doesn't do anything for bone density? And the reason is the minimum dose of force required in the hip joint, which is the joint that counts when looking at your mortality, it's the minimum dose is 4.2 multiples of body weight to trigger any bone growth at all. Well, I happen to know the guy that holds the world record in the squat, and he, when breaking the world record, does not exceed 4.2 multiples body weight. He weighs 300 pounds, and his squat is 1,200 pounds. So that's four multiples, not 4.2. So like when somebody says, well, there's no way I'll get osteoporosis, I work out. It's just like, all right, you're just uninformed. That's not the proper level of force that's required, and you're not going to get that through strength training. So where do you get it? Well, you get it through high impact. So like gymnasts, when they do a dismount from the uneven bars, they'll get 10 times their body weight. So high impact gives us incredible forces way beyond what we get with weightlifting. It's just delivered in a different way, and it's high risk. So gymnasts have the highest bone density, but they also retire at an average age of 19 because of injuries. So what is creating the greater bone density also creates fractures. So to me, it was like, okay, all I need to do is solve, it's an engineering problem. How do I get the benefit of high impact get the forces associated with high impact through the bone without doing actual impact, or at least lowering the risk of exposing bone mass to this type of force. So we just isolated the positions that I say we, it was really just me at the time, but you know, I did grow a big company out of this. So we took fixtures where we put people in an optimized position. So like 120 degree angle from upper to lower arm, and then back of the hand in line with the clavicle. That's for like the upper body. That's where you're either going to absorb or produce the greatest amount of force. And so there's four other positions in the body where we naturally absorb high impact force if we're to trip and fall or just have to basically brace for impact. So isolated those positions and allowed people to self-create force, but the only movement was from the compression of your actual bone mass. So the machines were just like they're controlled by robotic arms to get into the right spot, because you want everybody to have a very repeatable process. So you eliminate the positioning variables. And so the load exposure is the same every time. So I made it robotic and standardized. So somebody walks in and the devices all move in accordance to what the person's biomechanics are. And this is what you see when you walk into an OsteoStrong location. So that's the bone density treatment. And so once we made it repeatable by adding the robotics, people could expose tremendous forces. So we had a clinical trial. The first clinical trial was in London, University of East London. It was where the principal investigator came from. And then the rest of the researchers were physicians at the Stratford Village Surgery, which is in East London. And so they ran through 40 people, all postmenopausal, all either pre-osteoporosis, what's called osteopenia, or fully osteoporotic. These all of these individuals grew a huge amount of bone mass density and completely reversed their condition. And what blew my mind was when like the researchers would say to me, these people are holding 6, 7, 8, 9 times their body weight. But what do people use in a gym? And it's like, okay, so I know the gym, the forces in a gym are inadequate for bone. But what really are the differences? So I looked at the NANES database. For those that are listening that don't know what the NANES database is, it's a database that is compiled and maintained by the National Institute of Health. And what they're trying to do is just track health and fitness metrics. They add 2,000 people every year to this, and there's a huge battery of tests. So, you know, body fat, blood draws, or lipids, like every single metric for 2,000 people, and including gym data, their workout data. Sure. And it turns out that beginners in exercise are typically using 1.3 times their body weight to train their lower extremities. And of course, the lower extremities, the hip joint, this is what counts when it comes to osteoporotic fractures, because those are the ones that are associated with mortality. So beginners, 1.3, advanced athletes, 1.53, which is a long way from 4.2. Whereas the people who are using the OsteoStrong ultimately ended up becoming called OsteoStrong. And now we have 300 clinics in 15 different countries for this. Those people were using over 7 times their body weight. So they were way past the minimum threshold for triggering bone growth, and it worked incredibly well. And so that business is growing, and it's very exciting. It's all over the world. And then I spent a couple years just sort of traveling and lecturing. Went to the World Congress on Osteoporosis a number of times, and presented some of the early data. They called it preliminary data, which, you know, I was like, it's not preliminary. Like, come on. But very high standards when it comes to osteoporosis and data, because they're accustomed to looking at pharmaceutical trials, which might have 100,000 participants. Well, when you're testing a physical medicine intervention, that is, its basis is on the principles of what is taught, the basics of bone metabolism, like compressive force at the proper level will cause the bone to retain and assimilate minerals. Like, you learn this day one of medical school. So, you know, every time they would say, well, there's really not enough data on it. And I'm like, all data on bone is data that proves this works. All of it. Like every single study. We're still doing larger trials, but it's hard to compete with pharma type studies. And this is how I think this is part of the problem, why physical medicine interventions have kind of disappeared. Like, we only have pharmaceutical interventions now, because basically from an exercise science perspective, exercise scientists can't pull together the same size data samples, the same size studies that pharmaceutical companies can, because there's no profit margin there. So that was a challenge. Now, I managed to really get by that challenge and show enough physicians enough data where they, at the very least, they would say, I'll send a few patients over and see how they do. And every time that happened, like, absolutely incredible results. So then they send all their patients who have osteopenia or osteoporosis. So that was really the start. And then the second thing was like, wow, if humans are capable of so much, creating so much force in that impact ready range of motion, like, if I'm 7 times stronger here than I am here, and I wrote the study, I proved it to myself and everybody else. So, oh, wow. Like, that really means weightlifting sucks as far as triggering muscle to respond. In fact, there's a new sort of area of research that just talks about using weak range partials, or what's called lengthened partials. I don't know if you guys have paid any attention. This is like the last 6 months. A lot of research has come out on regular weightlifting and just working the stretched sort of portion. So, you know, short repetitions, really focusing on the stretch portion. Anybody who's a student of variable resistance will go, yeah, right. That's painfully obvious, because that's the only place that you're actually doing any work. When you pick up a weight, let's say it's a chest press, it's difficult from here to here. It's easy going the rest of the range of motion because you're so much stronger out here. So it really just isn't work. And so, obviously, okay, so you concentrated on the hard part. What if we changed the weight as we moved so that it was relevant in all positions? So, and that brought me to my second invention, which is X3. So massive variable resistance, very high ratio. So super heavy at the top of the movement and sort of a normal weight at the bottom.
I'm thinking about you're approaching a macro health problem from a different angle, talking about bone density rather than muscle growth. I'm going to ask a medically ignorant question. Does this grow muscle as well?
The bone density device?
Yeah.
No. It will teach you how to recruit more muscle, which can help you grow muscle if you're training muscle. And there's some arguments that there might be some myofibril growth, so some just muscle protein synthesis with no sort of extra storage of ATP, glycogen, or creatine phosphate, which is sort of the other kind of muscle growth. That's what's called sarcoplasmic muscle growth. So there's none of that. But you can produce more force. But like I said, it's more neurological than anything. So OsteoStrong is really focused on bone. X3 was sort of the same version, like it was a version of the similar logic, but really focusing on what muscle needs to grow the most.
Does this X3, and it's kind of funny that when I found out it was you that we were having on the show, three, 4 years ago, Phil and I met in a men's group. And the story of the X3 kind of circled underground in the group. And I was like, oh, here's the X3 guy. Does the X3 work have the same effect on bone? It clearly, you can build muscle that way, but does it have the same effect on bone?
No, okay. The weight isn't high enough. Like what the weight you use to train bone is ridiculously high. Like my upper extremities, when I'm compressing my upper extremities in an OsseoStrong device, I'll put 2,000 pounds through my arms. Whereas I'm not trying to bench press 2,000 pounds.
Right.
So very different.
When I was being taught to squat, one of the things I remember being told was first time I put a lot more weight on the bar than I'd ever imagined squatting. My son was training me. He said, just stand up. You don't have to squat it. Just stand up under the bar and get used to the feel. And I remember there was this, I don't know how to describe the feeling, but I know you're probably familiar with it. All of a sudden I had on my back significantly more weight than I'd ever imagined I could hold. I made no attempt to squat it. I just simply stood there with a whole lot more weight on my back than I believed I could, than I'd ever imagined I could handle. Is that, of course, that's not four times my body weight. I was going to ask, am I building bone by doing that? But
no.
If I understand, no, we're not.
No.
So I guess with that being said, you know, how do any of us avoid osteoporosis? Because ultimately, no one's really, you know, putting those forces on their bones.
Two ways: either find an OsteoStrong location or high impact. You know, like jumping off of stuff. You know how people like they hop up onto a box and then step down. You've seen people do like box jump training.
Yeah,
they should be doing the opposite. They should be jumping off of the box and stepping back up onto it.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, there's more risk associated with high impact, obviously. I mean, sort of people turn like 25 and it's like, oh, you should do low impact. Actually, I mean, everybody acts like they should be bubble wrapped now. you know, everyone's sissy. I mean, that's a shame, but, you know, like, if you are fully ambulatory and not in any sort of chronic pain, getting good at landing and getting force absorbed through the bone mass. In fact, there was an iPhone app that where you could just enter, you could log in, you enter your body weight, and you hold your phone on your thigh and you jump and land. And it'll tell you how many multiples of body weight you're capable of creating. Now, I built it as a tool to show people that no matter what they're doing, they're not even getting close. But then I let some marginally athletic people use it, and they could do it. They could definitely, you know, especially if they were standing on something like a park bench, 2 feet off the ground. Yeah, like you're getting it. So I'm in the middle of a redesign on the app, but it's called Fracture Proof. It'll probably be out in a couple months. Again.
Great. So I wanted to go back just a little bit. You know, earlier when we were talking about bone and you said, you know, kind of day one of medical school, you learn about the importance of these mechanical forces to help bone recruit the minerals. And I think you're giving maybe a little too much credit to medical schools because I certainly don't remember learning that. You know, what I learned about bone and osteoporosis prevention was take your calcium, and maybe there was a little mention of vitamin D. And, you know, along the way, I've now learned, you know, that actually the majority of bone or the biggest portion of bone is actually protein and how important protein is to bone, you know, bone.
Also, the idea that you take calcium and you grow bone would be as stupid as saying, I'm just going to eat extra protein and not work out and I'll grow all the muscle because all you need is protein, right? Right. So nobody would say that, but then we have these just completely ignorant physicians saying, oh, just take calcium. That's all you need. Really? So building block with no stimulus, huh? It won't do anything. In fact, it'll give you kidney stones.
And calcification in your arteries of your heart, by the way, too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Then you have cardiac problems. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, just very interesting. So, we always like to kind of go behind the thought process here. So why was it, do you think, that you were able to figure this out when, you know, kind of no one else had?
Mm. That's a good question. I got a good answer for it. My PhD advisor told me, so I invented the device and then I went to do my PhD. It's part of the reason I went to Rushmore University. They were the only ones that were willing to let me fund my own dissertation project. Because I went to universities and I was like, okay, like I could give you guys a grant, a research grant, and then you do a research project that I, you know, was sort of loosely designed, create the methods section for, and then you'll get a PhD student to make it either a project or a dissertation project. Right, no problem. And I had some good friends that were professors at the time at Berkeley. And then I'm like, okay, so you match my project up with like a random student. That's usually how it works. And they're like, yeah, you know, I mean, you have to approve of the student, but you know, generally there's a meeting here and there. Okay, what if I want to be the student? And they were like, oh no, can't do that. Why? What's the difference? They're like, and you know, I mean, they like laugh. They're like, because they're not administrators. So they're just sort of saying, you know, like how it is. And they're like, you know what? It's just never been done. Like, it's just unorthodox. And, you know, you don't ever ask a university for permission, because the answer will always be no. Because, you know, I mean, they just don't want to upset anything. They're bureaucrats.
Yeah.
You know, they show up. They show up at, you know, they're probably supposed to show up at 8, but they show up at 9. And then they're supposed to leave at 5 and they leave at 4. But as long as they don't, you know, you're a bureaucrat, like as long as you don't rape anybody at work, you're probably never going to be fired. So, you know, they're just going through. Oh, I have the same Myers-Briggs personality as Donald Trump. So I just say it how it is. I'm better on Twitter, though. So I'm listening to these guys and I'm like, do you see this is like totally stupid? And they're like, well, yeah, but I mean, we could build a spreadsheet for you of all the stupid things that universities do. And keep in mind, these guys were at Berkeley. Like these were in, my friends were in the material science area of civil engineering. And so, you know, they're just kind of telling me like, yeah, like it's like, you're going to have really like a lot of trouble finding this, because I wanted to, my goal, I was like, I want to be able to author papers, academic papers, but I also want to study my own invention. And like, why the hell would I trust somebody else to study it? What if they did it wrong? What if they half-assed it? What if, you know, like I should be the guy? Like, because I'm going to pay attention at a completely different level than somebody who's just assigned the project. And they were like, yeah, we totally get it, but that's just not the way things are done. So finally, I found a university that was willing to let me do it. And that's why I picked that one, Rushmore University. So I did published my dissertation. That's available on my website if somebody wants to read that. By the way, I don't recommend reading that. Very boring. It is for free on my website. It is worth every penny. it's just, you know, I mean, it's a dissertation. It sucks.
We'll get Grace Price to read it. We've got had an 18-year-old on who's already learned how to read a medical research study. So we'll get her to do it.
It's just exhausting. The problem. It's just like one of those things. It's like every little detail. Yeah, we wrote like 20 pages about it.
Yeah.
Like anything, you know, how to capture the load and get the loading into, you know, computer system. Like there's like 40 pages on that. Like, who the hell would even want to know that? But exhaustive. That's
right.
Kind of a thing in dissertation authoring. So what was the question anyway? I'm not exactly sure.
It was really just what was your mindset in kind of solving this problem that had never been solved before?
I started going down this. Basically, my PhD advisor told me, if you, that's why I went through with the order of things. So I invented it before I did my PhD. And here's the issue. It's like he said, if you had done it the other way around, if you'd had like maybe a vague idea of what you were going to do and you want to do a PhD in biomedical engineering, you would have talked yourself out of this. And I was like, why do you say that? And he says, it's so unorthodox. Like, what your approach to bone density is like absolutely the opposite of anyone else in the field. Except when I ended up showing it to the experts in the field, they were like, this is so refreshing. This is great. Like, I know like the pharmaceutical industry gets beat up on a lot, probably rightly so, for some of the biased data, maybe some of the lack of quality clinical trials, putting maybe profits over safety. We debate that endlessly, but I was pleasantly surprised that these guys who had spent their entire lives developing drugs and testing drugs for pharmaceutical companies were like, wow, this is a great solution for the majority of the population. Like, some people just can't physically engage their body, because of biomechanics problems or chronic pain. Also, there's a percentage of the population, not a big percentage, maybe 5%, just absolutely unwilling to do anything that requires effort. Like, some people are just, like, this is like the, maybe call them, I don't want to misuse this term, so I got to put a caveat on it, but pretty much like the fibromyalgia crowd. So like, fibromyalgia is, the definition is sort of unexplained pain. People perceive pain and they might actually have real pain. And it's not for a reason that's easily diagnosed. It might be a impinged nerve that is just showing inflammation in a different place. Or it could be somebody who's just a massive pussy who just doesn't want to do anything. And therefore they claim, and I remember like some of the first people I put on the OsteoStrong devices, I remember this one woman, she's like, ow, 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 ow. And I'm like, it hasn't started yet. You just sat in a seat. Oh. So, I mean, she's complaining about how much it hurts before it even started. And you can imagine how this went. Like, everything, hurt. Did it really hurt? No. She just, she loves playing the victim. If she's not an invalid, then she loses her identity. So, okay, just get out of here. So for those people, the pharmaceuticals are fine. But question, like I said, that's only like 5% of the population.
A question occurred to me as you were talking about impact. I've heard, can't remember who it was we had on the show, but they were talking about the benefits of jumping off of things.
That's right.
But then onto things.
Yeah, off of is what you need to do.
Yeah. And so the thought occurs to me, a couple of things. What are the, are there any common fields of human endeavor that generate these kinds of forces regularly? If so, what are they?
Yeah, gymnastics.
Common.
Well, that's the problem. No. I mean, common, no. And also, you're not going to take a postmenopausal population and say, okay, we're all doing gymnastics today.
Yeah.
Like, that's not going to happen.
We're going to do the parallel bars now. Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, so I think there's an area where maybe women are just starting menopause, or maybe before, where they can really build their bone mass to a significant degree by doing high impact, but, trying to control for the variables. So just landing from another surface. So you can go out to the curb and hop off the curb and see, use the software to see how much force that's getting through your lower extremities. And now also when you can, the monitoring and then the practice, like if you practice something, you can get pretty good at it. You rebuild your balance. And one of the things with the postmenopausal population, And I mean, we can say the same thing for men in their fifth decade of life. Are they really challenging their balance? Like in their activities of daily living? No, not at all. Yeah. But if they start doing this protocol, they'll maintain a lot of balance, and then they'll be able to induce enough force through the bone mass to maintain bone mass. And if they get past 4.2 multiples of body weight, they can grow. Make it more dense.
I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole with the
but
with the biochemistry of bone okay. growth. But I'm fascinated. Have there been any studies? Do you have any evidence, clinical or otherwise, of the other benefits of focusing on bone density rather than muscle growth?
Yeah. But, you know, because I'm the scientist of the company, I try not to say things like that. Like what we've seen here. Okay. What we've seen, but it has not been proven in research. So as long as
I don't care if it's clinical or not, we're
right. Massive pain relief, like joint, like there are people who are like my high school principal was one of them. He's had back pain since, I mean, I knew him as a little kid. In high school and in junior high, I lived in the Napa Valley, and I went to the Catholic high school in the Napa Valley. So I knew him even before going to high school, because he was a college basketball referee. And whenever you go to like St. Mary's games, you know, it's Catholic college, he was the ref. And, and just involved in sort of the Catholic Church in Napa Valley. And so I got to know him, and he was always in pain, always in pain. As soon as I developed the prototype, I called him, I still call him Mr. Schmitz, because it's really weird to call him by his first name. He's my principal, right? So, hey, Mr. Schmitz, like, you know, can you come and try this thing? I think it'll really help your back. And, you know, like, is it going to hurt? Because I'm already in enough pain. Like, just trust me. Like, I think it'd be fine. And it completely fixed his problem. He's like 30 years of back pain gone in like weeks. Because you're forcing the musculature. Remember I said neurological changes.
Right.
Engaging more tissue in the surrounding area, so the muscles more readily firing to support the joint. Another thing, in 1996, there was a study by Benjamin and Ralphs. That showed if you compress a joint on its axis, so this is the axis of a joint. So like this is not the axis. So end to end, loading this way, loading this way. You can force the tendons and ligaments, the joint capsule, to thicken with fibrocartilage, not to be confused with cartilage. But basically,
what are the implications of the thickened?
Better support of the joint.
Okay.
Like you're making a thicker, more powerful joint capsule by compressing the joint on its axis. And so that's a very curative approach to bone on bone. Like if you have a knee that's bone on bone, it's always going to be bone on bone. But you can certainly engage the musculature, the tendons and the ligaments to grow and take some of the stress off of that joint, pull that apart just a little bit. So that the contact is not so painful. So what will happen is somebody who's bone on bone in their knee, like scheduled for, you know, joint replacement, they do OsteoStrong for 6 months and they cut their pain in half. Then they're like, well, I don't need the joint replacement anymore. 6 more months, they cut their pain in half again. So now they've got 25% of the pain they started with. The pain they started with was debilitating. They like couldn't walk up or downstairs. You know, they have to sidestep. On stairs or something like that, in severe pain. Once you cut your pain by 75%, they're like, yeah, I still feel it, but it's not limiting. Like I can do whatever I want. So that is a side benefit to OsteoStrong.
Let's, I want to go back to the muscle building and dig into that a little bit more. Talk about the concept of variable resistance and, you know, what it is and what advantages is it has. You kind of touched on it a little bit, but let's go a little deeper on that.
You want the entire movement to be relevant. And like I was saying, this phenomena with the lengthened partial. So just doing repetitions in the weak range of motion gives you the same result as training with a full range of motion. Right. But in that lengthened partial range, that's the only place, if you're lifting a regular weight, that's the only place you're really working hard anyway. So it makes obvious sense to me. I think this whole lengthened partial argument is a monument to why you would want to do variable resistance. Because with regular weights, the weight is only relevant when you're at the bottom. It's easy up here. So it's like you're doing nothing.
Okay, because I'm the dummy here, I want to make sure I'm clear on that. It's relevant at the bottom because you are forcing the muscle to do what the muscle is not up to handling yet. And as you get closer to your maximum
strength. Not quite. No, the bottom of the movement is just the limiting factor. It's where you are weakest. It's where you're biomechanically, just from a leverage perspective, at the greatest disadvantage. It's also where you have the least amount of muscle tissue engaged. So it's always going to be weaker. So with the bottom of the squat, you know, you're doing a squat and your butt's almost touching your ankles, your heels. Yeah, you're not powerful in that position at all.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a lot of people who can't do a body weight squat where they go all the way down and all the way up. They got to grab onto something and help themselves up. So that's the position where you're doing work. Like if you're lifting a regular weight, it's only hard at the weak points. And then the rest of it's easy. Sort of like I said, most people can't squat their own body weight if they go all the way down. But if you tell somebody, even somebody who's out of shape, bend your knees and just stand there, letting your quadriceps hold you up as opposed to just your bone mass. Yeah, stand there with your knees slightly bent for hours. Like, not hard work at all. But you get somebody and say, squat down and leave your femurs, your thigh bones parallel to the ground. How long can you be there? You know, most people like half a second, maybe 2 seconds, maybe athletic people like 20 seconds. But it's like you're massively weak in that position. So the idea of variable resistance is change the force so that it's relevant in all positions. So when I do a chest press, I have 200 pounds at the bottom. Halfway up, it becomes 300 pounds. Then all the way up, it becomes 550 pounds. But I would never get under a bar with 550 pounds on it. I mean, first of all, I'd never get it off my chest. And also, there's probably no spotter who could lift it off my chest if I couldn't lift it myself. So I'd probably die. So I'm getting the benefit of that 550-pound bench press. But the risk is very low.
That makes sense. We had Mark Ripito on, and then we had Ben Bocchicchio. Here in the last couple of months. And it was fascinating to hear the two guys who've been in it for 50 years and with different approaches. Mark is very, very clear. He's about building strength. It's that simple. He doesn't care what your body looks like. It is strictly about getting stronger. Ben is more, although they both have similar looking bodies from 50 years of working out, Ben is a little more focused on the overall fitness aspect of it. Both of them are it's weights that they're recommending.
Yeah.
Slightly different approaches, I think. You know, for the average Joe like me, any of these programs that I picked up would help me. The differences in the details, and for the folks who are, you know, probably the top 20% would see difference. And that leads me to my question. For the average Joe like me, let's talk about the X3 and the types of results that could be expected and the type of work that can be done. And specifically, I'm thinking about time spent working out weekly.
So I want you to think about the people you know. This is a fun, this is a very fun question you asked. I got a great answer for it. So think about all the people you know who engage on a regular basis in fitness, some type of strength training or whatever. Let's say it's 20 people. Out of those 20, how many of them year after year look exactly the same? I'm guessing 20.
I would think that.
The vast majority of people, whether it's 99% or 99.9% of people who attempt to be involved in strength training, other than maybe the gains they get in the first couple of weeks, end up with nothing, like nothing at all. They look the same, feel the same, same strength. And there's some huge reasons that nobody's really willing to talk about because they're genetic, as in there's nothing you can do about it. Well, almost nothing you can do about it. So this is my TED talk is very controversial because this is why I covered this in my TED talk, that the difference is it, the funny thing is it shouldn't be controversial.
I thought that was fascinating.
Painfully obvious.
I watched your TED talk and this fascinated me. I want our audience to hear this.
I've never
heard this before.
Tendon insertion. So my pectoral muscles, the origin is on the sternum. Everybody's the same. But where it connects to the humerus bone is usually right at the top, right here. And, so as I'm doing chest exercises, I'm basically moving the humerus bone towards the midline of my body, shortening my pectoral. So whether I'm doing a pressing movement or a flying type movement, basically the same thing. Now, some people have this insertion point, which I know exactly where mine is. I can actually physically feel like, when I go to like make my pec jump like this, I can feel, dig in underneath my bicep and I can feel that where that tendon is. Some people have it way down the bone, almost on the other side. And when you have that, you're probably going to be in the NFL. Because when you pick up weights, or one of my favorite NFL players spent a summer mowing lawns when he was 14. I think he gained like 50 pounds of muscle.
Mowing lawns.
Yeah. I mean, just a kid from, where was he? Like Middle Tennessee. A lot of people have big lawns. So he just went and mowed lawns. And, at the end, it was like, he's a freshman in high school. Everybody was like, you should probably go out for football. Especially like, wow, what do you bench? And he's like, oh, I've never even seen a bench press. Like, okay. So you got to go see the coach. And so these guys, because of the fact that they have a lever built into their body that is made of the most elastic material on earth, tendon, it's almost like they're training with rubber bands on the inside of their bodies.
Right.
And those rubber bands are forcing incredible muscular engagement. So these are the people, and everybody went to high school with a guy like this. I feel like, at least I did, where, everybody starts sort of lifting weights freshman year. And then, by the beginning of sophomore year, it's like one guy, like everybody looked like they were 14 freshman year. And then sophomore year, everybody still looks like they're 14, except one guy who all of a sudden looks like he's 25. And it's because of this, advantageous tendon layout. And some of these people, like I said, they tend to be in the NFL. Another really easy one to spot is really high calf muscles. So people of African descent have higher calves and a longer tendon. Well, that longer tendon is going to give them more recycled energy with every toe strike. And engage more musculature as they contract that calf. So like, you know, us European descent people, we have longer calf muscles. But are we ever going to be as fast as people with higher calf muscles? Nope. Which is why not a lot of white springers. You know, the way it is. But it's a perfect example where it's like, oh, I mean, like, that's kind of obvious. Now, it's easy to see the tendon insertions and the distance of a muscle compared to where the ankle is on the calf. It's most people, you can't really see where that's going on, but the similar geometry can be echoed throughout the body. And that's why, I mean, it's just, like I said, it's like 1% of the population, they pick up weights and they just grow. And everybody else, they can do all the same stuff and nothing. And so with variable resistance, you bypass this because in that weaker range of motion, you're handling a smaller amount of weight. And so you're basically taking your internal leverage sort of like off the table, because as you begin to shorten the muscle and gain a mechanical advantage on it, it's starting to fire anyway, because that long sort of lever arm effect that those genetically gifted people have just becomes less relevant, and everybody can engage in the same way, which is why when people got X3 a couple of years ago, they were putting on 20 pounds of muscle in 6 months. And now that's a really good result. That's not absolutely everybody. But that was common. Like, we have thousands of people who have written reviews to that tune. And you think 20 pounds of muscle, there's people who've been working out 20 years and they haven't been able to gain 5 pounds of muscle. Or they think they've gained 5 pounds of muscle in 20 years, but it was really just fat.
Yeah.
And talk about the role that, you know, one of the things that the X3 does is it really allows you to push your muscles to failure safely.
Right.
And what are those advantages of really getting the muscle to failure?
Well, two things. You're getting the muscle to fatigue where it's in its strongest position, which is something you can never do with weights. And this is why variable resistance has been traditionally associated with strength training. So the strongest people in the world, in fact, I'm in the middle of doing some filming. I'm making a documentary. I filmed with two former West Side Barbell athletes. Now, West Side Barbell Club was a private gym in Ohio, in Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, yeah.
They have more world records out of that gym than any country on earth. It's just one gym. So how'd they do it? How'd they break all these strength records? How'd they get a bunch of strong people to sign up and be members there? Well, they just started breaking all the world records, and they did it with variable resistance. So they realized that you can engage the human body much more, build a lot more muscle, get the body accustomed. This is what your son was trying to do to you when he you know, get the weight on your back, just get used to feeling that weight, and then you can work on your range of motion. So that's a very smart approach. But variable resistance sort of does that for you. Like, when you're in that stronger range of motion, you're handling way more force than you otherwise would be able to put on your body in a gym type environment. And but as you back off that position, it becomes a more normal weight. So the fatigue in the strong range. So when I go to fatigue and, you know, I've got 550 and then I can't do those reps anymore, then I do shorter range repetitions or lengthened partials. So, and that's with 200 or 300 pounds, which is, you know, much more like fatiguing in a standard sense, but I've already fatigued so much more musculature in that stronger range of motion. So it's just massive superior stimulus.
I know you've been doing this for a while, and this is probably an impossible question to answer, but what is the experience subjectively of of doing a bench press with the X3 compared to a barbell or doing a squat or a deadlift? How is it different other than
massively more work done? Like, you can continue to engage past fatigue and you're dealing with much more weight because it's a strategic approach to get as much force through that muscle as possible. So like if I were to do a regular bench press, you know, let's say I would do 225 for repetitions. Okay. But with variable resistance, I might hit 550 pounds at the peak 20 times. And then be training with 300 pounds for the next four or five repetitions. And then 200 pounds for the next four or five repetitions. So it's just a massively incredible amount of work you can get done in one set. And that's why the stimulus is so much more powerful.
Is the recovery longer?
No. Same.
Why?
No, it's the way the body works. Yeah, I mean, recovery is recovery. What most people are recovering from after a workout is damage. And it's sort of a myth that you create like little micro tears in your muscle. And then when the body repairs those, the muscle becomes stronger. It's actually the opposite of that. As you damage the muscle while you're training, that repair is actually what's taken away from growth. Only when you don't damage anything and just stimulate do you have pure growth.
Wow, you're in over my head now. Help me out, Phil.
There's a lot of research on it.
Like, I'm at the limits of my understanding now.
Yeah, I mean, basically, what you're saying is, if I understand correctly, is you can't repair and grow kind of at the same time.
So when people damage musculature, it's just the damage that repairs itself, and you don't grow at all.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, again, that kind of, as you said, I mean, that's a very common misconception that you hear out there, you know, yep. That you got to do the damaged muscle to stimulate it to grow. Yeah. So that kind of brings us into, you know, talk about the role of nutrition and the building blocks that you then need to get muscle to grow, and I guess it really is the same to get bones stronger. Right. You know, what's involved in that?
High quality protein. That's really the answer. Almost everything I eat is animal protein. Like the only exception is like, I'm not going to be the difficult guy that like sends the steak back because they put some chimichurri sauce on it. I just kind of scrape it off and eat it. So like pretty much just meat and water is my diet.
And what kind of, what do you think the right amount of protein is for people?
Oh, a lot of literature on this. 1 gram per pound of body weight is the most common finding. Now that's total body weight, not lean body weight. But also most of it was tested on people who are around 20% body fat. So I would just, you know, if somebody's like really obese, like I would tell them to adjust that number to imagine they had 20%. So they're 500 pounds, you know, you don't need to eat 500 grams of protein, but you might need 250 grams. Yeah.
And what's your take on, you know, there's a lot of debate around, you know, can you do this basically like in one meal? Do you have to divide it up into 6 meals a day? You know,
that's not a debate anymore. Well, it might be people who don't understand how things work. But the amount, this is a direct quote from a study that came out a couple of weeks ago. The amount of protein that can be used for anabolism, meaning growth of tissue, is unlimited. So I eat 1 meal a day usually, and it's usually like 2 or 3 pounds of steak, just in one sitting. It's really convenient only eating once a day. Like, I don't have to horse around. Also, like, my wife knows not to get in my way when I'm preparing dinner. It's just like, hey, just don't get in my way. That's it. That's all you got to worry about. Yeah.
You're probably not the guy to ask for the official scientific medical answer to this, but because you eat that way, you may or may not have had this experience. Do you have any mineral problems? Like, do you have to supplement with?
That's a great question. And no, I got a great answer for that. I was worried in the beginning, like, there's got to be, like, we've been told all kinds of micronutrients that we need and vitamins and all kinds of stuff. The lowest quality recommendation in medicine, and by quality, like, you know, when you have multiple randomized controlled trials that came to similar conclusions. So that would be like an example of strong or quality evidence. When it comes to vitamins and minerals, the AMA doesn't have anything better than what they came up with in the 1950s, which was based on expert opinion, which is bullshit. Like, expert opinion based on, who are the experts in the 1950s? Because nothing was measured back then. So, like, they didn't even have normative data. Like, I have a problem with normative data in general, because saying, you know, you're outside of normative data, it's like, yeah, great. 75% of people are overweight or obese. So why would I want to be like them? Just, you know, the normative data just thrown in the trash. Like, I don't want to be like everybody else. That's a stupid recommendation. But when it comes to vitamins and minerals, the recommendations are, like, wildly outdated and easily provably wrong. So here's a question, and I want both of you to answer this separately. Imagine you couldn't have any supplements, but you could source your foods from anywhere you wanted in the world, which, by the way, people never did until now. I mean, I love the vegans who are like, well, you know, you need, it's essentially you have your nut butter from Madagascar. And it's just like, you fucking idiot. What are you talking about? Nobody ever had that. You think you need that to survive? Like, literally nobody had that, including the people in Madagascar. But like, they've only been doing this like the last 10 years, and they wonder who's buying their stuff. Like, who's the sucker that's buying this stuff? It's unbelievable. Anyway, so if you were to just eat whole foods, to get to the recommended allowances of vitamins and minerals ascribed by the American Medical Association, how many calories would you need to take in? So just take a guess. How many calories to get all your vitamins and minerals in one day?
No supplements. I wouldn't have any earthly idea how to answer that question.
I'm going to guess 3,000.
Okay. Jack, really?
I'm old enough and have dealt with enough different health issues. I've learned how to eat for myself to make myself feel good. And the way you just described 3 pounds of steak a day, that sounds like nirvana to me.
It is.
I had steak last night. In fact, Phil, I ate a steak that you sent me last night. Thank you. That was just spectacular. Made that for Valentine's for my wife and I. That's a nirvana for me. For my meal before the podcast, I had a mixture of hamburger and scrambled eggs with some homemade yogurt that, so good.
Yeah, that's amazing. So take a guess. I need a calorie number. How many calories to get all your vitamins and minerals ascribed by the American Medical Association?
1,500.
Okay, 1,500.
I don't think about 3, calories.
The answer is 25,000 calories.
25,000.
Yeah. So yeah. You need to eat 25,000 calories of whole foods to get to the minimum amount of vitamins and minerals. So now, aside from the fact that if any human tried to eat that, they would die way before 25,000 calories. Also, a rhino does not eat 25,000 calories in a day. Like, that's just a crazy number. So obviously, these recommendations are just ridiculous, and they don't mean anything. And probably all of us have, according to the data, massive vitamin deficiencies. But guess what? We're not sick. There's nothing wrong with us. So the recommendations are just dumb. So my advice is don't pay any attention to them. They are just as stupid as the whole 25,000 calorie thing. So unless you plan on eating 25,000 calories, just, and no one can, just forget it. The whole argument's dumb. Also, there's another study that they did on women. I don't think it's gender specific. I think it just happened to pick women. People who take a multivitamin actually die younger. Now, is it because the vitamin is bad for them? No. It might have something to do with placing false hope in something that you think is going to help you, but in actuality does nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I know people who they take like some sort of thermogenic supplement to lose body fat or lose weight, as they call it. And it's like they're obese and they're taking this every day and they're eating garbage, thinking that it's their fat burner that's going to save the day. Of course, it never happens, but they don't ever convince themselves that it's not working because they want to believe it's working. You know, and now we have Ozempic, which is like the latest, like, oh, this will solve all my problems. Yeah, cause a bunch of other ones, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you kind of touched on protein quality there. Yeah. But just again, your take on it, you know, animal proteins versus plant proteins. Can you do it with plant proteins? Is there any role for plant proteins in your mind?
No. Plant protein. Like if you try and do it with just plant protein, you'll die of malnutrition. You have to supplement. Now, some of my, like I make a product called Fortigen, and that's essential amino acids. That is the byproduct of bacterial fermentation. Now, if somebody's willing to go down the fermentation road, and I mean, a vegan could eat kimchi or sauerkraut, which are fermented vegetables, and so they can get some of that. But it's like you got to eat so much of that stuff to make that much of a difference. So I would just say, like, and vegetable protein, as far as usability based on its the prevalence of essential amino acids, most plant proteins are lower than 9% usable by the body. And it's just because they have the wrong amino acids. We don't have, maybe said another way, because our appendix no longer functions, and whereas like in other primates, the appendix does function. The appendix is involved in extracting amino acids out of fibrous plant mass. So like gorillas and monkeys can do it, but we don't have a functioning appendix, so we can't. Like it just goes right through us. And that's why plant protein is just a waste of time. Like it's not garbage, but it's, you have to eat so much of it, it would kill you before you would even get to the minimum usable amount by the body. And if it's refined like pea protein is, what we find in pea protein is a lot of heavy metals, because they're grinding all these vegetables up with metal blades, which are putting basically powdered metal because the blades are, you know, shearing each other. So there's a little bit of powdered metal that gets into your pea protein and gives you mineral poisoning. So, like, why don't you just have a steak and not do any of that other stuff?
Oh gosh.
Yeah. So, that question. Yeah, that question solves, I think, a lot of the world's problems. Why don't you just have a steak? I think that's a great way to sum it up.
Yeah, I mean, we...
So...
2 million years, that's all we ate. And we thrived. Somehow, didn't even have healthcare.
Exactly.
People still thrived. Yeah.
How has your physiology changed? I am assuming that you are your own best customer. So how has your physiology changed since you've gone down this path? I'm not going to limit it to the X3. Let's take it as far back as you want.
I wish I were my own best customer because I'd have a lot nicer shit. I always get the broken X3 bars. I get the bands that are like defective. It's like my Fortigen cans are all crushed. It's like, oh yeah, somebody drove over a pallet of Fortigen, so you can have all the broken ones. You know, the cobbler's kit has no shoes. So that's what I get. But it doesn't matter because it works really well. How's my physiology changed? Well, I was probably a really average looking guy, like on my 40th birthday. Like, I mean, I was 20% body fat. I weighed 190 pounds. So, you know, a little chubby, not strong, despite the fact that I'd worked out for 20 years. I got nothing out of it. Also, had been on testosterone replacement therapy for 12 of those years.
At 40?
Yeah. I had a bad accident at 28, testicular damage from a rugby hit. So I was playing club rugby, semi-pro rugby, after college. And I just got a bad hit. And, you're supposed to wear a cup, but nobody does because you can't really sprint. And I was an outside center, which is like a wide receiver. So, like, you need a lot of speed. And the last thing you want is a cup.
Yeah.
Until you get hit. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, yeah, that's why. I had some significant testicular damage in it. It lowered my testosterone to the point where my cardiologist was like, your heart is super weak. And I'm like, I play rugby. How is that possible? Like, rugby is 80 minutes of sprinting and stopping. I should have the most powerful heart ever. And fortunately, the guy was like, you need to see an endocrinologist. I think you have that testicular damage that you had that affected your testosterone. And so I did my blood work. I had 167 nanograms to the deciliter of testosterone. So normal is between like 800 and 1200 for, maybe like African-Americans, and 600 to 1000 for like white, Hispanic, and Asian people. So, I mean, I was horribly low. And I was to the point where my cardiologist said, you might actually have an adverse event in like before, you know, you're like through your middle adulthood because of this. Like, you need to make your heart stronger. We need to get you testosterone replacement therapy. And of course, back when I was 28, so this is a while ago. This was, you know, that's 19 years ago. I'm 47 now. I was like, wow. Like, I thought testosterone was steroids and steroids are bad. And fortunately, my endocrinologist is like, yeah, well, what you see on the news is stupid. Like, that's not at all how it works. In fact, there's more testosterone receptors in the... I'm actually curious if this is true. He told me there's more testosterone receptors in the heart versus all the other muscles combined. Have you ever heard that?
Yeah, I actually haven't heard that, but it wouldn't surprise me to learn that that's true, I guess.
Right, because people who think about steroids, they have enlarged hearts.
They get heart failure and enlarged hearts, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so you know, I was confused. Yeah,
the heart's the muscle your body wants to...
Yeah.
I was just going to say the heart is the muscle your body wants to protect most. So
absolutely,
it would make sense.
Yeah. So once I got on testosterone replacement therapy, my heart started working perfectly and I didn't have any other issue. But That didn't even a decent dosage of testosterone did not help me grow any skeletal muscle. And then it was like, so I turned 40 and my birthday present to myself was I had a prototype of a device built that I had an idea about. I said, I think this is going to change everything. I think we're going to train with very heavy variable resistance. And this should solve the tendon insertion problem. And boy, did it ever. I put on 30 pounds of muscle in the first year. And like, I was unrecognizable. I would go back to like a fraternity, like, reunion, and they would, do a double take and like not recognize me. And they're like, oh my God, John Jaquish, like, what happened to you? I looked like a completely different human being. And like to this day, like I don't, I have a shadow under my pecs. I never had that before. I have visible abs. Never. I had that, but I was like, that was like in high school when I was like, 130 pounds.
Yeah.
So, that doesn't really count for anything. Much stronger, much leaner, better performance.
Is the only variable that has changed the X3?
Yes. Only. So my nutrition didn't change. I was carnivore before. Just X3.
How tall are you?
Interesting. I have grown. And some wellness experts think it's because of the fasting that I do. But I was 6 feet tall from the time I graduated high school to up until recently. And now all of a sudden I'm 6'1". Oh, for whatever reason.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow.
In my 40s, I've gotten taller. Like, I don't know why. Fasting cool. Does increase growth hormone. But I mean, growth hormone makes you grow when you're a kid.
Yeah.
Like, not now. So, yeah. I mean.
You don't do any other biohacking?
I mean, fasting, I like that. But I mean, like red light therapy or.
No, wait, is this a hardcore fasting like those Harvard students did this last week where they fasted for 12 hours to protest? I don't know, whatever it was. Or.
Harvard students are usually protesting something.
No.
No. This is like 72 hours.
Well, try that.
So 72 hours, no food, no water.
Is that frequent? How often do you do that?
Well, I used to do it every week, but then, I started losing the fat around my eyes, and it was like this, like a shadow, like surrounding my eyes started showing up, and I just started looking really skeletal.
Yeah, that's me. That's why I'm actually only 27, but I
fasting. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, like when you get a certain level of lean, especially with natural athletes, I think because anabolic steroids keep your blood pressure higher, you don't see that in steroid users. But like if you watch an actual tested natural bodybuilding competition, the faces look really sunken in.
Yeah.
And I think it does look a little scary. It's just not a good look. It's also not sustainable. So who cares? It's like you only look like that for a day, and then you like
right.
have a couple of sips of water, and it's like okay, that's gone. Yeah, your body doesn't like it.
I pus back up.
Any limits in terms of? I've got one more question, Phil. Any limits? I'm going to go straight to the X3. Any limits? In terms of the big muscle building movements, Mark Ripito says there's only five exercises you need: squat, deadlift, bench, overhead, and row, and that'll hit all the big muscles and that are supported by all the smaller muscles. Are there any limits with the X3? And if so, what are?
In fact, all those movements you just mentioned are like the core movements of X3. So Mark's a smart guy. He's right. Now, I mean, will you get like a bodybuilder would have a lot of problems with this conversation.
This is not a bodybuilder.
Yeah. I mean, are there some accessory things you can do for like the posterior deltoid? You know, if you want a bulge right here, yeah, sure. But, you know, I mean, most people will never get lean enough to even find that muscle. So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, Phil.
That's a good question.
Device.
No, great questions. Yeah. This has been, this has really been a fascinating discussion. We've touched on bone, muscle, and we even touched on primate appendixes. So I think people will learn a lot from this one. Where can people find out more?
Well, because my last name is so difficult to spell and pronounce, my website is drj.com. You know, Julius Irving's just fishing right now, so he didn't need it. So it's D-O-C-T-O-R, the letter J.com. And there's links there for Superior Exercise, takes you to X3, Superior Bone Density, takes you to OsteoStrong, Superior Nutrition, it takes you to Fortigen. I would say if you're going to follow me on, there's links to all my social media on drj.com, but I prefer Instagram. I just like the platform. I think because it requires you to type on your phone, a lot of people are a little bit lazier. And so you don't have the same amount of sort of jealous rage tantrums out of the trolls, you know, it's just sort of like, they just,
that may
sentence
be,
complaints.
That may be the best explanation of why you could do one platform rather than another, because yeah. It's too much effort to be a troll on Instagram.
Yeah. Like Instagram, there's really not a lot of. Like there's people who just say like, you know, one, like you'll post 10 studies to support a thing and then someone's response is bullshit.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, so which of the 10 studies did you have a problem with? You know, it's just, they don't want to believe it. So it's like, okay, well, you know, they've got a place for people like you. It's called the Democratic Party. You can have 62 different genders. Go there.
I'm going to ask you a question about your Myers-Briggs after we've stopped recording.
Cool.
This has been John Jaquish on the Stay Off My Operating Table podcast. I've loved just getting to hear you talk and getting to ask these questions. And I know a bunch of my buddies are going to be interested in this as well. Thanks for being with us, everybody. For Dr. Philip Ovadia, this has been the Stay Off My Operating Table podcast. And we will talk to you guys next time. Oh, you know what? DrJ.com, DocTorJ.com. Everything will be in the show notes. Now, we'll see you next time.
Chances are you wouldn't be listening to this podcast if you didn't need to change your life and get healthier. So take action right now. Book a call with Dr. Ovadia's team. One small step in the right direction is all it takes to get started. Contact us at ifixhearts.com/talk. That's ifixhearts.com/talk.